And thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno of the George Washington University and host of Planet Forward, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane's on a cruise with public radio listeners. Suicide bomb attacks on three government buildings in Baghdad have killed more than 150 people now. And in Afghanistan, 14 Americans died in three helicopter crashes. Joining us now for an update on the recent dramatic events in Iraq and Afghanistan and implications for U.S. strategy, Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, Thomas Ricks, senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and Peter Spiegel, senior national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Good day to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in. No shortage of things to talk about in Iraq and Afghanistan these days. Tom Ricks, let's start with these incredible bombings in Iraq and the shockwave they've sent through the military and political systems there. What signal were they intended and intending to send?
I think they were intended to send the signal that Maliki does not have the control over Iraq that he asserts. And that's really his sole campaign plank is, look, you may not like me, you may not like how we're running the government, but at least you're feeling safer. And I think it was designed to undermine that. I was struck, I read this morning, that one of the trucks used to do the bombing was stolen in Fallujah, which indicates it probably came out of Anbar province.
Which means?
Which means it's Sunni extremists probably working with al-Qaeda. Simultaneous large blast is perversely one of the al-Qaeda signatures that they like to do. We all remember that from 9/11. And it indicates to me that that's what's going on.
And which means, Nancy Youssef, that Iraq is, what, nowhere near as stable as the previous lull had indicated?
Well, it indicates that sectarian violence is still continuing despite the U.S. military assertion that it's not as aggressive as it would be. These were Sunni attackers hitting Shia government buildings. It's an effort to sort of revitalize the sectarian fighting. And I think it raises questions about ultimately what Iraqis and what Americans consider acceptable levels of violence in Iraq. Can these sort of occasional massive bombings, you'll remember the last one was in August, will the Iraqis accept that? Will the Americans accept that as a condition for their leaving, that these attacks will continue to go on? There are fewer attacks, but they're becoming more and more spectacular.
And Peter, at a critical moment.
It is a critical moment because we have elections coming up in January. And just to not be overly pessimistic here, because as Nancy mentioned, there was a very similar attack in August. We did not see the country descend into another round of sectarian violence. That's the good news. The other good news, as Tom pointed out, this seemed to be very politically oriented. You know, there are elections coming up. You know, Maliki is vying for position with other Shia parties, with Sunni parties. Is this just a domestic political issue being expressed through violence? If that's the case, there's an argument that as long as there's some sort of Sunni outlet for through the political system, this may eventually go away. Now, the problem is there appears to be no Sunni outlet for legitimate political expression right now because most of the parties are still dominated by Shiites, and a lot of the government institutions are dominated by Shias. They're using them to suppress Sunnis in the country. So as long as that continues, as long as there's no legitimate way for Sunnis to express their political outrage, this stuff could continue.
Do you expect this stuff to continue?
I do, actually. The last line of the last book I've written on the Iraq War, The Gamble, is a quote from Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who said to me twice in the course of 2008, the events for which the Iraq War will be remembered have not yet occurred. There's a significant chance that this war will go on for another 5 to 10 years. I think we're going to have American troops there for many, many years. They'll call them trainers and advisors. But this war is far from over.
But Tom, as they leave, as we have pulled out of the cities and we withdraw to concentrated areas around the country, what vulnerability then does this latest string of events suggest for the innocent public in Iraq trying desperately to put their lives back together again? Because it suggests that the vulnerability is extreme.
Recently, the former mayor of Talofer, a city up in the northwest, wrote a very interesting essay in which he said all the conditions for civil war in Iraq are still there. This is why I think the surge failed. It succeeded tactically. It improved security.
For the moment.
Yes. But its purpose was to lead to a political breakthrough, and that didn't happen. That's not my saying what the purpose was. That's what the president said the purpose was.
Nancy, I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is when you ask then at the Pentagon, look, there have been two massive attacks in the last few months. What are you going to do? And there's sort of a shrugging of the shoulders. The status of forces agreement calls for us to leave. And the Pentagon's focus on Afghanistan now. And yet, if you go right below the surface, you can feel from soldiers who have served, who wear bracelets of fallen comrades, the frustration that potentially the United States is leaving as sloppily as it entered, that you've got 120,000 troops still based in Iraq, and yet nothing is being done to stop this.
Nothing is being done to stop this?
No, because the line at the Pentagon is, we're waiting for Maliki to ask us for help, or we're waiting for something like the Samara Mosque bombing. Okay, but if it gets to that level, it's already too late. I mean, the Samara Mosque bombing didn't happen in a vacuum. That was a building of sectarian violence that manifested itself in a very violent way.
One other issue, there are still 120,000 troops in Iraq, which everyone seems to forget, which is about the levels they were preceded the surge. It's still a very big level. But what is happening sort of in the granularity of that is a lot of the assets that are needed to track down these bombing networks, the UAVs, the unmanned drones, the intelligence assets, communications, all that is being sucked over to Afghanistan. And having spent time with General Odierno, who's the commander there a year ago, his real sort of the thing he was most proud of was the ability to track down these networks through human intelligence, through systems like unmanned drones, and dismantle them. Well, if you move all those assets to Afghanistan, are you still able to dismantle those bombing networks? They're clearly still being, you know, sort of roving freely into Baghdad and be able to do these kinds of attacks.
These bombs went off near three important government buildings. How much of a setback did this present to the fledgling, struggling Iraqi government itself?
I don't think we know yet. I mean, you saw the government try to respond by passing an election law, which they've been debating for several months now as a way to sort of speak up. I think you're seeing it hurts Maliki the most, as Tom mentioned, because his political platform, his election platform, is I bring security to you. You saw rival political parties trying to exploit that. Haidu Ahmadi, who's head of the rival Shia group, suggested that this was a failing of Maliki's part as a way to gain votes. The security question is sort of the keystone question in the election. So I think we're going to really see how the government responds to it in the election itself. If I could just add to that point that Peter was making earlier, you know, the 120,000 troops, the way General Odierno is keeping them in is through those elections. The majority will start leaving after the elections, and that's where he's buying time. My concern becomes what happens if the U.S. is needed and there aren't enough troops to provide the kind of support that the Iraqis expect.
Tom Ricks, what does the Iraqi government want from the Americans at this point?
They want them to leave, but not yet. This is what everybody in Iraq seems to want. We hate you, but not as much as we hate everybody else here. So we don't want you here, but don't leave yet.
I mean, this is a brutal sort of corner that they're painted into, right? Because they want them and need them for their protection, but they want them and need them to leave.
And, interestingly, we want to leave also. President Obama's likely plans for Afghanistan turn on getting troops out of Iraq. They're planning on basically keeping troop levels, as Peter said, pretty much the same all year. It Bush-era levels, and then bringing them down very quickly next year. That's a real gamble. What if you can't bring them down? What if the Maliki government says we need those troops? Suddenly, it doesn't matter what General McChrystal wants in Afghanistan. They're not going to be available troops.
So let's turn to Afghanistan for a moment, because as we have all of this playing out, as Tom just pointed out, in Iraq, we have this waiting game in Afghanistan for the next strategy. And the President of the United States saying he will not rush his decision on whether to send additional troops there. Doesn't matter what the former Vice President Dick Cheney or anybody else is saying, or at least that's his public line. Peter?
Well, it's interesting. That has been his public line. You're starting to feel a little bit of uncomfortableness in various places about that. First of all, frankly, in the Pentagon. I mean, I think there was a lot of hand-wringing about, look, you fired the former commander. You picked the new commander. He's come back with his recommendation, and now something that was supposed to take weeks is now taken more than a month. You're also seeing some concern on the ground. I've been hearing from soldiers coming back from Afghanistan, who are saying, look, we're going out there saying you have to support your central government, you have to support the election, come join the Afghan National Army. And they turn around and say, well, hold on a second. In Washington, you haven't even made a decision what you're going to do. Do we decide to go along with you?
You know, a few weeks ago, I had Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates over at the university, and we talked to them, and I did a lot of talking with a lot of people in preparation for that interview, to include via Skype and other wonderful technologies, people on the ground in Afghanistan. And you know what I heard again and again and again? What I heard is, we feel like we have our hands tied. We feel like the politicians are talking. We have a job to do. We want to get out there, and they're not letting us do it. So the frustration seems to be from the bottom up as well.
And I think the most interesting thing from that interview you had, because Secretary Gates was very open about that, and he was more in reference to Pakistan than Afghanistan, but he said, short term, we're going to have some uncertainty. And this uncertainty is continuing now, probably well into November.
Well, he flat out said that the situation is deteriorating. He was openly concerned about that.
It is. And actually, I'm hearing about Afghans who you would want to be investing their money instead of liquidating it and saying, yeah, the Americans look pretty soft here. It's really probably time to get out of Afghanistan for a while.
You mean leaving?
Yeah.
You're talking investors, business people. You're not just talking about the bad guys.
That's the day-to-day cost of this dithering, as Vice President Cheney, I think, accurately labeled it. You can hear the gnashing of teeth at the Pentagon so loud that you can hear it across the river now.
Nancy. Absolutely. And you can hear it on the ground as well, because from their perspective, General Crystal was brought in to change the momentum. And all of a sudden, that spark is gone, because there was a strategy, there's now a new strategy.
But some have said this is part of a play to really lean on Karzai, lean on the Afghans, make them understand that, you know, this is not something they can take for granted in an important review at a critical time.
But leaning on Karzai, what does that accomplish, and what does that accomplish so far? I mean, Karzai,
a runoff.
And is that a good or a bad thing? Some would argue that's a bad thing. We're anticipating, if there is a runoff, that the turnout will be half of what it was the first time, which would put it at about 17%. A lot of Afghans won't even know that there is a runoff election going on. And the Taliban has already begun threatening people who try to go out to vote in the next election.
Peter.
One other element that probably should be mentioned here, we tend to forget them, but our allies are also beginning to scratch their heads. I mean, the Brits just sort of signed up for 500 more troops for Afghanistan. The Prime Minister went to the Commons and said, we support General McChrystal. NATO has... And they're looking for the U.S. to make a decision here, and there's a lot of scratching their heads in Europe as well.
We're talking about the latest situation in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and we'll have more with our guests right after this short break. Welcome back. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. We're talking about Afghanistan and Iraq with Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, Thomas Ricks, he's senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. His most recent book is titled The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. And Peter Spiegel, he is senior national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Folks, we were talking about the stalemate in Afghanistan and the waiting game for the Obama administration to determine its policy. We want to invite our listeners into the discussion as well. So if you've got questions or comments for our panel, please join us at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email with your question at drshow@wamu.org. We'll be getting to your calls and questions in just a few minutes. Nancy Youssef, there's a front page piece in the Washington Post today that is really remarkable reading. U.S. official resigns over Afghan war. The official is named Matthew Ho. He was called in by the ambassador, Carl Eikenberry, in Afghanistan, asked not to leave, offered a senior staff position. He was brought back to Washington, had an audience with Ambassador Holbrooke, Secretary Holbrooke, and on it goes. But he left anyway, and he wrote a scathing letter of resignation on the way out, a quote piece from it. I have lost understanding of and confidence in the strategic purpose of the United States presence in Afghanistan. I have doubts and reservations about our current strategy and planned future strategy. My resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing this war, but why and to what end.
Yes.
Strong stuff.
Absolutely.
Who is this guy?
He's a former Marine captain who served in Tikrit in Iraq, Saddam's former hometown, so he has seen and fought a counterinsurgency war. This is sort of the epitome of the kind of foreign service officer you want, someone who's been on the ground, who understands the nuance and how the State Department and the Pentagon and the military need to relate at their best. And he says that the United States presence may be driving Afghans to become violent, that that the U.S. presence may be emboldening the Taliban.
Counterproductive.
That's right. And it's a damning statement from someone who really is an example of the kind of foreign service officer the United States wants. And I think it's the timing of it is significant as we're in the middle of this Afghanistan debate. People who are on the ground, I think he sort of epitomizes the frustration on the ground about what the United States strategy is and what it's accomplishing.
Okay, Tom Ricks, you're not at the Washington Post anymore, so I can ask you this question in just this way. Is this the Washington Post trumping something, throwing it on the front page, making a big deal out of something that's not a small deal, but not exactly a front page? This guy, you know, wasn't elected to the position. He's not president of the United States. Or is this really a big deal?
It's they overhyped it. They played it much too big, I think. It's an interesting story. Everything Nancy said is correct. It's intriguing. It should have been a small box on the lower left hand of the front page. It should not have gotten the play it got.
I mean, I picked this paper up today, and I have to catch my breath. It looks like it's falling apart.
Yeah, but then you read the article, and you go, oh, my God, who's going to run the Xerox machine at the embassy now?
Well, he was doing a little bit more than that.
Not much more. He's like a first-year Foreign Service officer. I don't think they trust them yet with the keys to the men's room.
Peter?
I think the other thing that's worth pointing out is a lot of the points he is making about the U.S. mission in Afghanistan was said 3 years ago in Iraq, that the U.S. president is just causing more violence happening, particularly in Anbar province. Their presence they should leave. The only way that the violence is going to end in Iraq is for the American presence, which is such a finger in the eye, to leave. Well, we know what happened in Iraq. That didn't necessarily happen. So I think the interesting thing is shared by many people who were senior in the Obama administration. So I don't know if this guy is necessarily that important, but certainly his analysis is shared by others. But I think it's worth noting that a lot of the points he is making were made 3 years ago in Iraq and frankly proven wrong.
Nancy, here's a question from a listener. Why shouldn't Afghans vote on U.S. occupation during their upcoming election? Would give the U.S. a legitimate reason to stay or go?
It's a good question.
Well, how do you think they'd vote?
I think they'd vote leave. Frankly.
You do. The Afghans.
Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, the Afghans that I've spoken to, yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is Afghanistan's not like Iraq in that it's a lot more diverse. So how one village feels could be exceptionally different in the next village. But, you know, when you talk to Afghans, they don't want the Taliban. They don't want the Americans. They just want to be left alone. And I think the Taliban is an element at least they know. You know, we always talk here about how the Afghans don't like the Taliban. But they know how to relate to them, at least. And the Taliban provides a tangible service on a local level by people who they recognize, whereas the American presence is a lot more ambiguous.
Tom Ricks?
I agree with what Nancy's saying about they know the Taliban. I was really struck in an interview I read with some villagers who told the Americans, look, we didn't like living with the Taliban, but unlike the Afghan police, they didn't rape our little boys. That's a real problem when the police come in and are predatory against the population. That said, I'm not sure I agree with Nancy's conclusion that Afghans would vote for us to leave. The majority of Afghans are not into Islamic extremism, and they didn't like living under the Taliban. Anybody who wants to understand the Taliban should go look at the movie Osama. Got nothing to do with Osama bin Laden, but a beautiful movie about what life was like in Kabul under the Taliban.
You point this predatory behavior out, but you have to point out, too, some of the excesses that did take place under the Taliban regime, which were beyond horrible. Public stonings and beheadings and cutting hands off for perceived crimes. Women who were not permitted to go to school or to be out on the street, for that matter, unless they were completely covered and then under certain limitations. So I think we have to be very cautious about how we project on the Afghan population how they view this current situation.
Yeah, I hate to be the house optimist here, but I mean, if you look at public opinion polling in Afghanistan and take that for what it's worth, whether it actually really be done, the Taliban still polls at single digits. The question, do you think the U.S. is helping should stay is in the 60s. So it's still very high. Now, again, as Nancy points out, this varies significantly by region. I think in the Pashtunistan, in the south and the east, those numbers are in the 40s or something along those lines. But there still is a, again, compared to Iraq, there still is goodwill amongst the Afghan people for what the NATO mission is doing.
Is the question on the table in front of the Obama administration still essentially counterterrorism versus counterinsurgency? Or has that question changed? Because it was somehow portrayed, at least early on, as do we stay or do we leave? And it was never that kind of black and white decision.
I think that question, and I think generally the McChrystal plan has been badly presented and not understood. I think the McChrystal plan actually calls for counterinsurgency and counterterror. Do counterinsurgency in the population centers in the south and the east, Kabul, the Host Bowl, Kandahar, the Helmand Valley, and Herat. Do counterterror in the vast, rural, empty areas that are used by Taliban and Al-Qaeda to come into the country.
Yeah, I would just add to that. In Iraq, it wasn't a counterinsurgency versus counterterrorism. It was a combination of both. And the debate isn't one or the other. I think of it as a spectrum on two ends. And the question becomes, where does the administration fall on that spectrum?
I spoke to an Air Force general who put it this way. He said, why can't what works in Pakistan work in Afghanistan? Infiltrate local populations, have special ops very aggressively on the ground, use drones and air power very strategically and reasonably surgically, because it's never going to be perfect, right? And then you deploy as you need to, as opposed to this very heavy presence on the ground. Now, this may, I see Tom's laughing here, this may be an Air Force perspective, that's why I'm identifying the general from the branch he comes from, but is there something to that, Tom Ricks?
I wouldn't take any recommendation on, hey, let's do what we're doing in Pakistan. Pakistan scares me. I'm actually relatively optimistic about Afghanistan. Pakistan is falling apart. Pakistan has Islamic extremists and nuclear weapons. That is an existential threat to this country in a way that nothing in Afghanistan is.
Peter?
And I would just argue, and a lot of this question about why are we in Afghanistan, I would argue that a lot of what happens in Afghanistan is we're doing because of Pakistan. There is no way to surround the area in Pakistan where the extremists are without the U.S. and allies coming in from the left while the Pakistanis come in from the right.
These things are all connected, and we started our conversation today with a discussion about what's taking place in Iraq and the bombings there. And I want to just read another email that we got here from Daniel. This is very interesting. He said, these attacks that you were talking about here, but put these in context. In 2007, Iraq was a disaster. Suicide bombers, sectarian violence occurring in several parts of the country just about every day. He writes, in 2009, Iraq is more or less on its own in terms of security in the midst of a political transformation. Emerging democracies are always violent, he says. Most political analysts note post-conflict recovery takes decades, not years. While the latest attacks are a sign Iraq has its work cut out for it, it also is naive to expect the country to be anywhere near the end of its transformation. Answer.
You know, what Daniel's really asking is, what is an acceptable level of violence and what is an acceptable pace for development in Iraq? And I don't think those questions have been answered. I do think in the United States we make the mistake of comparing everything to 2007 levels. In Iraq, the military will say, we won't get involved unless it gets back to that level. That was the worst of the worst, and that was in a clearly unacceptable level. And there's a point in between then. So is it better than it was in 2007? Yes, but I'm not convinced yet that the Iraqis accept this as such. And you look at Iraqi history, there hasn't been the patience historically for decades and decades of evolution in terms of its government. There's been 20-some leaders, and Saddam was an anomaly. He wasn't the normal. This is a country that goes through leaders pretty quickly. So I think you have to take all that into context and in terms of determining whether this is the right pace or whether it's too fast or too slow.
Peter Spiegel, you're senior national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, so you cover this beat on a daily basis. You're talking to sources and people all the time, some of whose names you can use, some of whose names you can't. What are you sensing is the internal dynamic now on this wrenching debate over what to do in Afghanistan?
The sense is we are moving, if as Nancy describes it, the spectrum was counterterror or the Biden plan on one hand and the McChrystal plan on the other hand, which is a more manpower-intensive counterinsurgency strategy. I think we're moving towards the McChrystal end of the spectrum. I always thought that the Biden advocates were a very small minority, even amongst the civilians. And I think that's being bared out. I think particularly Secretary Gates who frankly I think is probably the most important civilian in this debate, has hinted in frankly in your interview yes. and in other public appearances that he supports McChrystal view yes. of the world. I wouldn't underestimate the extent to which what is happening in Europe over the last couple of weeks also. The fact that Gordon Brown came out and embraced McChrystal. The fact that Rasmussen, the Secretary General of NATO, came out and embraced McChrystal. The fact that NATO as a whole last week embraced McChrystal. They wouldn't be doing this without some coordination with the White House. I think we're seeing a lot of tea leaves that are moving into the direction towards McChrystal.
And what are the allies saying and doing these days? I mean, the United States is not, it's by far the largest force in Afghanistan, but by no means the only one.
They're worried. I think you're picking
allies. The allies are worried
about the Americans. Kind of what's going on here? This is the first big foreign policy question that the new president has taken on, and he hasn't inspired a lot of confidence.
Why? Because of the delay? Because of the public deliberation about it? What else?
Well, the public deliberation is not really his fault. Somebody leaked the McChrystal assessment, and that didn't do him any favors. But on top of that, a lot of people thought back in March when he gave that speech, okay, it's settled. He's laid out a strategy. McChrystal is now going to tell him how to achieve that strategy. And so that kind of stutter step hiccuping is really worrying people. The process, how Obama's handled this, is as worrisome as whatever the eventual outcome
what
is.
What do these allies, the Germans and the British, for example, want the United States and this administration to do?
They want the administration to come out with a solid strategy. They also understand that Obama does need to bring along the country politically, and so they're willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. But the stakes are going up every day in this. In order to make this thing stick, Obama's going to have to really sell it to the country.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. I want to go to the phones now, and we'll take our first caller. Susanna, she's calling us from Port Charlotte, Florida. I think I've pronounced your town correctly, Susanna. I hope so anyway. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you. I'm not as eloquent as Daniel was earlier, and you were speaking about Afghanistan. I just wanted to say that between the country in Iraq, that's a civil war that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. It's a religious-based war. We don't understand that kind of war. We shouldn't be involved in that. Maybe as a police, you know, for a short period of time, but not the way we are. We should get out of there.
You think we should get out? You think we should get out of both countries?
No, not Afghanistan. That is something that we need to do to protect our country. But as far as Iraq goes, if you put in context the civil war that happened in this country, each Battle of Antietam, lost thousands on each side. That's the nature of war.
Okay,
that has to go on.
Okay, Susanna, thanks very much. Let me get some reaction. Nancy Youssef and then Tom.
Well, I hear Susanna's frustration, and I think, as Tom pointed out earlier, the United States wants to leave. But I think it has to be thoughtful in how it leaves, because I think the worst case would be to lose the ultimate treasure of the United States, 4,300 soldiers, to then leave something that's more unstable than when it came in, because that has implications for the region. So I think, as appealing as it is to leave, there has to be a real thought process to it, and a deliberate technique to how you leave that country.
Tom?
I agree with the caller in that I think the invasion of Iraq was the horrible mistake, the single biggest mistake in the history of American foreign policy.
The single biggest mistake in the history of American foreign policy?
I don't think we have any idea of how much more blood and treasure this thing's going to cost us. This is a mistake that's going to live with this country for decades. That said, once you recognize it's a mistake, which I think this country has, as Nancy says, you can't just leave. As my friend David Kilcullen says, just because you invade a country stupidly doesn't mean you should leave it stupidly. The question is, how do we leave it in such a way as to minimize the damage we've done?
Peter Spiegel, is that assessment, that this is a colossal mistake that somehow has to be managed and set right, the approach that and the attitude that the Obama administration takes toward this thing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't say, obviously in the campaign, there was much rhetoric about what a colossal mistake this was. But what you hear now in government is this exact point. We can't leave with the same way we went in. We have to do it much more, you know, deliberately and much better plan. I want to get to this issue, though, that Susanna, the caller, raises about civil wars in general. Mm-hmm. Civil wars, yes, are about elements within a country fighting each other, but they do have a tendency to bleed out into other parts of the region. The Balkans was certainly a civil war that NATO and the U.S. allies decided we needed to clamp down and prevent that kind of spread. It gets also back to the issue that Nancy keeps talking about, which is acceptable levels of violence. I mean, David Petraeus in a period of quite frank and open honesty said, you know, look at Northern Ireland. Can we get Iraq to Northern Ireland levels of violence? Which is, bombings go off, but the functioning of the government and the society happens around that. Is that what's happening in Iraq now? And I would just, again, trying to be the optimist on the panel here, perhaps, maybe that's what we're seeing. Maybe we're seeing a turn towards Northern Ireland level of violence where a country can function, but there still are occasional bombings every other month.
Of course, the other possibility is that we're turning toward a level of Beirut violence and I think back, I was covering the White House years ago, and I remember when, with much expectation, Bashir Jamal was installed as president, won an election of sorts, talked about peace and all this kind of thing, and then the bomb under the table blew him up in his cabinet, and the country descended into hell.
And the Lebanon example also is one that once you thought you actually clamped down on the violence, a couple years later it will spurt up again.
That's right. It's like squeezing a balloon, and it's all but impossible.
Ambassador Crocker in Iraq once said to me, and Crocker is an expert on Lebanon, having lived there and been blown up there, actually, that his best case scenario for Iraq was Lebanon.
His best case scenario for Iraq, which means what?
That's kind of... there would be a government, there would be persistent violence for many years to come, that there would be sectarian differences.
And America left Beirut. America left Beirut. More on this conversation, more of your calls and questions for our panel talking about Iraq and Afghanistan today on The Diane Rehm Show. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
Louisa May Alcott's Little Women has entertained readers for generations. A new biography of Alcott reveals her own life was as interesting and epic as that of her most popular novel's heroine. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Our guest today, Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, Peter Spiegel, senior national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Thomas Ricks, senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Nancy, quickly to you, you wanted to make a point about the Taliban and Afghanistan before we go back to the phones.
Yeah, I just want to point out that when people ask do they want the Americans to stay, I find increasingly people who have interactions with coalition soldiers want them to leave, because I think the Taliban can commit a lot of egregious acts against Afghans, and they'll accept that to level. But one egregious act by an American is unacceptable by the Afghans. And so you have to look at it in that ratio versus how many violent or egregious acts have the Taliban committed versus the American ones.
Cheryl from Raleigh, North Carolina, joins us on the phone now. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. I would like to ask Mr. Siegel and the other guest, how long should the American people wait until our commander-in-chief chooses to make a decision which his general and the battalion commanders under him who are in the field have given him their best estimates of what is needed to win the conflict in Afghanistan and protect our soldiers and our country from further violence? And I'm just wondering, is there a time limit on this? I feel like we're being led sometimes by a man that I voted for, but I can't like right now very much.
Okay, Cheryl, thanks. Very very interesting and I think widely felt sentiment if you look at the polls.
Well, I wanted to answer it that way. I mean, her sentiment is shared by many people within the administration, within the Pentagon, and within the allies. So that sentiment is getting up to the White House. Particularly this issue of, as Tom pointed out before, you came out in March with a strategy. You fired your commander, you picked a new commander to implement that strategy, and now we're having another review. There's a lot of, as Tom says, teeth gnashing over that.
I mean, there are other, how shall we put this, less thoughtful radio shows where this topic comes up almost daily, and the president is pilloried for this kind of Shakespearean hand-wringing.
Well, there are practical issues as well. I mean, to get the army in, they need about 6 months' notice. And if you want to get them there by fighting season, which starts in the spring, we're talking about early November, which is when we expect a decision. The Marines would need about 90 days. So there are practical considerations that will force this decision sooner rather than later.
And also, let's not forget that General McChrystal, in his now famous assessment, says we have about 12 months to turn this around. If that's the time clock, every week we wait to make a decision, you know, affects the way General McChrystal.
So with all your great sources, any idea when the decision's going to be made?
Boy, every week I think it's going to happen, and every week they say another couple weeks. I mean, there are a couple of timetable things we can look to. First of all, we have, obviously, the Afghan elections happening November 7th. There's some indications that the White House wants to wait till after that.
If there's a legitimate government.
Yes, exactly. The other thing to look at is on November 11th, the president is traveling to Asia. The indications from the White House is they want to make a decision before then. So there's a magic window somewhere between the 7th and the 11th of November, and I'd keep an eye on that.
All those frequent flyer miles. Abdul joins us now from Washington, D.C. Hi, Abdul. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Just fine. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. This is my first time caller, and I'm a long-time listener. I'm from Afghanistan, and I came from there last June, and The reason I was calling is that Afghanistan is getting worse and worse because a lot of people are playing politics and nobody really, really cares. One of them is that that Afghanistan, the capital of Afghanistan, after 8 years, finally they have the power. And that power came from Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. That is unfortunate.
Do you have a question for our panel with your very interesting background?
The question was, how come with all this coalition force and all this countries trying to do help Afghanistan, and after 8 years, they took him to just give the power to the capital?
Okay.
So nobody's doing his job.
Why is the power and the influence still focused so much largely in the capital as opposed to the rest of the country? Who wants to go for that? Nancy?
Well, I would just say, you know, we hear about this as an 8-year war, but the truth is it's been 8 1-year wars. The United States has never fought this war cohesively. So in a lot of ways, after 8 years, unfortunately, the United States is starting over. Politically, I don't think the United States has ever put real pressure on Hamid Karzai. There have been approaches to him, could you do this, could you do that? He'll say no, and the United States says, okay, and you're still our ally. And so it's the combination of those two things. It's a lack of cohesive strategy. Remember, for many years, we only had 20,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
You're saying that despite Senator Kerry and Ambassador Eikenberry and all the other missions and the calls from the president, that the United States is not leaning on Hamid Karzai, who is accused of corruption and is being ineffective in extending power outside the capital.
Right, but when did that leaning on Karzai start? It started in 2009.
Too late.
We'll see. I mean, was it happening in 2003, 4, or 5? I would argue no.
Just to get to the caller's point on the regions, there is quite a bit of looking at, can we decentralize governance in Afghanistan because of its very reasons. Karzai's government is known to be corrupt. And Afghanistan is by tradition, a regional state. It is one that is always ruled from the provinces. The problem a lot of the troops are running into, particularly in the south, is literacy rates are at 5-10% in places like Orozgun. How do you get a society that has no literacy and no experience in governance to all of a sudden step up and govern themselves.
That's a really interesting and important point, and it's something that you hear and I've heard directly from people you talk to, from troops and others. You cannot underestimate how difficult it is to pull a society together, to leapfrog essentially generations in a sort of political process when you have the vast majority of the population in places that cannot even read.
I used to live in Afghanistan when I was a teenager. And I just want to speak up on behalf of the Afghans.
Just a couple of years ago, Tom?
Tom was a teenager?
And in fact, I was a member of the Afghan Ski Patrol, junior grade, skiing the Selang Pass.
Is that right?
Yeah, my father taught at Kabul University for 2 years. And I went back in 77 when I graduated from college. I want to speak up for the people of Afghanistan. Illiterate is not stupid. The average illiterate Pashtun knows hundreds of proverbs, maybe thousands, has memorized many, many poems, very much part of the Afghan culture. They do know how to govern themselves. They have governed themselves for centuries. They've not been at war for centuries. Afghanistan was actually remarkably peaceful compared to much of Asia for the 20th century.
It was peaceful when you lived there?
Well, very much. I mean, I used to knock around. I actually visited, I made it my goal to visit every town in Afghanistan with a population of more than 5,000. Made it to all except Maimana in the northwest and Faizabad in the northeast.
And you were a kid?
Yeah, just
getting, getting around the country.
Hop the bus. Take the bus.
Without fear of being kidnapped or all these horrible things that people seem to think is...
My parents were maybe nuts, but I used to say, well, my dad, I'm going to Herat for the week, you know, or I'm going down to Peshawar to buy some books, go to the dentist. You know, okay, Tom, you know, see you in a couple of days. We're going to Kashmir. Afghanistan does know how to govern itself. I remember somebody told me recently that the Loya Jirga, the Afghan form of self-governance, is actually closer to classical Greek democracy than our hyper-individualistic form of democracy.
It's closer to our New England town hall meetings in some ways than we'd like to admit.
A consensus-driven deference to the group over the individual, yes.
Here's a question for you from an emailer, Leon, who says, Iraq is a back to Iraq is a complete disaster, no good way to leave, no matter what we do, how long we stay. When we leave, it'll just devolve into a nightmarish civil war. You think that's inevitable, Nancy? Or you think that Leon's onto something here?
I think Iraq has to correct itself more organically, that the system in place, that the institutions in place in a lot of ways are artificial, and that eventually Iraq will correct itself and carve its own course, that its military may be trained by the United States but will operate in a very Iraqi way, that the government may have been set up by the United States but will operate in a very Iraqi way, and that needs to be sorted out. Maybe it will be violently, maybe it won't. We'll
another see. Another email here, this one from Kathleen. How do your guests explain that you can click through 100 TV channels in the United States and not see or hear a mention of what The Lancet reported, that close to 1 million Iraqi people are dead, thousands injured, millions displaced, along with little or no news about American soldiers who returned from Iraq with missing limbs, etc.? One thing, Kathleen writes, that's become clear about what our leaders learned from Vietnam, don't show the American people pictures or clips of what's really taking place. It's not the government's decision to do that, though, is it, Tom?
The Lancet study... As my colleagues know, there's been a lot of doubt cast on it by other experts, statistical experts. That said, yeah, I think Americans don't understand the amount of violence that has been wrought on the Iraqi people, how many displaced people there are internally, how many people have left the country. This is a country that's been severely wounded. When I hear people say, well, it's the Iraqis' fault, they need to clean it up, I think, no, we have a more responsibility to do something more than just boogie out of there.
Back to the phones. David joins us now from Syracuse, New York. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for your call.
Okay. Well, I have a comment, and I want to disagree with the people who are criticizing the president for being careful in his consideration of our policy in Afghanistan. I particularly want to disagree with Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney is a reckless and careless person. It's why you should never go hunting with him. And his carelessness is one reason why we ignored Afghanistan for seven years and went into Iraq, which, as one of the other commentators said, is the greatest foreign policy mistake in American history. We need careful consideration to figure out this very complex problem before we commit more resources to it, and hopefully before we make more mistakes, as we have been making them for most of the past decade. This is very serious, very important, and it deserves very careful consideration. And I don't think the president should be criticized for delivering that careful consideration.
Okay, David, thanks very much. Peter, that certainly is the posture of the administration and those who have said, and I've actually heard it from some in uniform as well, who say it's totally appropriate to stop, pause. There's too much at stake here to make a mistake. Consider it all.
And Secretary of Defense Robert Gates makes the same point, pointing out also when he was in the Bush administration, the extent of the review that happened before the surge was also over a course of about 3 months. You know, real change that was driven through by the White House. So there is a case for deliberation. The only point I think people are making is we thought this deliberation happened in February, March. You change your commander to picked a guy who's going to prosecute a strategy. Why are we doing this stop again?
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, please feel free to do so. Call us at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email. We're trying to get to some of those as well, as many as we can, at drshow@wamu.org. Nancy Youssef.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think Peter's absolutely right. I think part of the frustration is, at least during the debate, during the surge, it was public. We knew what the United States was debating. The Kagan plan was out there. Megan O'Sullivan had a plan. You knew what the United States was considering. This has been very secretive, and I think that's part of the frustration that yes, it should be a deliberate process, but it's not one that the public's being included on. And Kabul, some would argue that General McChrystal isn't being included on as much as he would like. So I think that's the underlying frustration.
Tom Ricks, one of the perils of being around this town a long time is you start to see things happen more than once. And I'll go back to when George Herbert Walker Bush was elected president. And he'd been vice president for 8 years under Ronald Reagan, in case anybody forgets. George Bush the first conducted a 6-month policy review of America's approach to the then Soviet Union. And there were howls from the balconies saying, what is taking you so long? You were in this administration. How can you not know? What are you doing? When are you going to have your policy? I mean, is there something that the public and that we in the media fundamentally miss in terms of the complexity and the time it takes to do these sorts of things?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think there's a point at which deliberate becomes dithering. And I think the Obama administration probably blew through that line a couple of weeks ago.
Peter?
Well, I'm an objective reporter and don't indulge in commentary. But the extent to which that reviews of policy happen with regularity and take months of time is certainly something that happens in this town quite frequently. The only issue that McChrystal points out in his assessment, which I pointed out earlier, is there is an urgency here. You know, U.S. policy towards Soviet Union, we can afford to take 6 months. If we believe General McChrystal, we need to act now because we've got a 12-month window to really turn this thing around.
Let's go to Bob in Toledo, Ohio, for a call and question. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, thank you. There have been a few reports that we are paying very large sums of money to the various factions and warlords and whatnot in Iraq, and yet there's been hardly any discussion in the news media or elsewhere as to the significance of those. What would happen if we maintain the current troop levels and pulled those payments? What would happen if we pull the troops and leave the payments? I think it's a very important part of the issues, and yet it's not discussed at all. And I would like to hear your people discuss it.
Okay, Tom Ricks, discuss it.
I just wish there was more discussion of the war in Iraq. I'm fascinated by the situation in Anbar province west of Baghdad, but I'm finding almost no reporting on it. The payments to Sunni insurgents, to warlords, and so on were covered pretty heavily back in 2007-08. The total for the U.S. was about $30 million a month for about 100,000 Sunni insurgents. Remember that this was not a surrender by them. This was a ceasefire in which they were allowed to keep their weapons, their organization, and even their areas of operation. I actually thought it was a good deal. $30 million bucks is about what George Steinbrenner pays for a mediocre second baseman. If that will end a war in Iraq, I'm all for it.
Anybody else?
Well, I think a lot of those guys also who are getting paid by the U.S. have gradually been integrated into the Iraqi payroll. You know, there's some cause for optimism there that the security forces in Anbar now are made up of a lot of these guys who are now being paid by the central Iraqi government.
Tom Ricks and Nancy and Peter, I want to ask you this question very briefly. We only have less than 2 minutes left. But a lot of the questions that we've had here and a lot of the discussion that we have revolves around having good information or any information from these places. And we're having this conversation at a time when many in the media are downsizing, cutting back. Are we not getting some of the basic information we need from these places because the media in this country are imploding at the current time?
Yes, and also because it's extremely dangerous to report in Afghanistan, and I actually think still in Iraq. And so in order to have reporters there, you have to pay for security. The Washington Post's budget just for security in Baghdad was running about $1 million a year.
$1 million a year just for security.
Yeah.
Nancy?
You know, both stories also demand nuance. That, you know, the early days of the war, an explosion, as horrific as it is very linear. It's a very easy story to cover. Both in Iraq and Afghanistan, it requires a nuanced storytelling, and that requires a certain kind of reporter that fewer and fewer organizations are willing to pay
Peter?
For.
Peter?
I just want to talk about one other thing that's going on now that is not being covered, which is there is an offensive going on with 30,000 troops in Pakistan and South Waziristan, perhaps the most consequential offensive in the last 20 years in Pakistan. And because of lack of resources, because of danger, and frankly because Pakistanis don't let Western journalists out there, really we are unable to get that detail out there. And that's going to have huge consequences for both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Meanwhile, the British are deciding whether and how to deploy more. The Germans are actually fighting on the ground. So there's a lot happening. Tom, what's the thing to watch, you think, over the next couple of weeks?
Any word out of the Obama administration, and especially when the administration makes a decision, what they do publicly. Do they try to bring along the American public?
Nancy?
I'm watching Abdullah Abdullah, who's the rival candidate to Karzai, and how he reacts in the weeks ahead.
Peter Spiegel, last word to you.
Those are the twin things. What does the White House do, and what does the election happen on November 7th?
Peter Spiegel, Thomas Ricks, Nancy Youssef, thanks for a great conversation today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. Thanks very much for being with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.